Hello, I'm Simon.
I'm Dan.
And this is the Wikicast, a podcast where Wikipedia takes us to a random article each week and we talk about what we find. Dan, what are we talking about this week?
This week, Simon, we're talking about Hymnus Amoris, an opera by Carl Nielsen. I thought this was kind of fitting because, I mean, we're choristers and, well, choral scholars.
Yeah, choristers. Choristers implies that we have a certain degree of innocence.
Yeah, well, which... it also implies that we are little children.
Well, I mean, which we're not. You do somewhat look like one.
Okay.
This is where the podcast format is.
Whoa. Okay. It says here it was his earliest choral work. It was performed by the Music Society in Copenhagen in 1897.
That's interesting. So, okay, so a little bit of backstory. Whilst we are both singers, we're both musicians, mm-hmm. we are both nothing compared to my mum. My mum is actually an amateur opera singer, which I don't think I've really talked about on the vlog before.
I don't think so.
So she might even know this. What was the name of this again?
Hymnus Amoris by Carl Nielsen.
So she might have even done this, for all I know. Mm. So that, from her being my mum, I've acquired a certain amount of background knowledge about opera. So I know that that is the tail end of what I guess you could consider the classical opera kind of period, like that's the period, like post Verdi kind of time, post Wagner, like quite a bit post Wagner, but before stuff like Peter Grimes came in, like the more modernist kind of operas. So that's interesting, actually. So 1891, did you say?
Yeah. Oh, 1897.
Okay.
For soloists, choir, and orchestra.
That's interesting.
Opus 12, and it's his first choral opera. It's his earliest choral work, so it's the first time he would have been writing for voices.
Do you think that when people say that, like, they never even did any scraps of paper? Like, it was just like, I want to write something for voices.
Yeah,
I'll do an opera.
I would assume that it means formal, kind of published work.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have just been kind of leaping in, kind of, you know. I imagine if we went to his apartment in 1897, there would be the equivalent of post-it notes all over his house with little kind of things written down here and there, you know.
I don't know, what kind of musical composition would you put on a post-it note?
I don't know, something fairly short, perhaps.
Responses.
Yeah, each one. On one post-it note, O Lord, open thou our lips, on the second, and our mouth shall show forth thy praise.
Can you tell that we weren't kidding when we
said we were choral singers? I don't know if we've spoken
about this before. We literally live and breathe this stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely love it.
Not anymore, actually, I suppose, because it is the summer. Mm. We're recording this and it's been a glorious couple of days in Exeter, actually.
Lovely, yeah.
The students have gone away apart from us.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've been soaking it up and not doing anything, actually.
I had a marvellous day yesterday in that you went off to the office to do, because you're doing a PhD.
I'd like to point out, I went to the office, this was about 9:30, I'd guess, because it was a little bit late for me. You were having your post-breakfast nap.
I was. I am 55. I'm not sure if anyone knows about this, but... Oh, right, I think a backstory is necessary, because I need to justify this. It's not that weird. I didn't have a... Well, apparently I did have a really good night's sleep. Anyway, I naturally
woke. Where did you
woke.
Sleep?
I slept in my room.
Oh, okay.
Which is,
for once.
Yeah, for once, because usually if Simon's not at home and I can get away with it, I will sleep on the sofa because the sofa is comfy and I can watch a film. And
also, he fits. That's the thing. I can't.
It's a snug little. I cocoon myself in. Yeah, I woke up at 5 and I thought, well, we may as well start the day. So I came downstairs and made some lovely breakfast. It was all very, very nice. I ate outside in the morning sun.
Had eggs and soldiers.
Eggs and soldiers, a cup of tea, listened to a bit of Radio 4. It was quite nice.
You really are 55.
Yeah, I love it. I then came back inside, did the washing up, came in, and just decided to have just kind of a little lie down. I felt I earned it, you know. Anyway, next minute, I'm waking up for a nap. In fact, I wake up to you, I think, taking a photo of me. Is
yeah,
right?
You woke up just before I could take it.
Oh,
it was really
that's
annoying.
Such a shame.
I was going to put it on Twitter and, yeah. Really, really, you really ruined it.
It was brilliant. I don't know if anyone else gets this, but sometimes if you have a nap, you can sleep for a bit too long. And then you wake up all groggy and it's not very nice.
Yeah, you wake up in like the deepest part of your sleep cycle.
Yeah.
Like I cannot nap.
Okay.
I nap maybe once every couple of months. Mm. There's something about it I just can't do.
Because I would have napped for maybe 45 minutes to an hour. And I think if you push it over an hour, that's when you start to feel a little, you know, groggy and... You don't wake up feeling particularly refreshed. But it was such a good day.
Sorry, do you want to get your phone there?
Yeah. Ever the professional. Don't just mind me. I'm going to turn that off. It was such a good day that I decided to do a load of washing, and five loads actually, and they were dry. They were drying in the space of 20 minutes.
You
per
messaged
load.
Me again. We really can't emphasize enough how middle-aged Dan is. The fact that you watched Wimbledon after your post-breakfast nap and mm-hmm. did washing, and you messaged me really excitedly saying, "I've done like 4 loads of washing
it's
today."
Amazing! I was so happy. I actually, I had a when
you
I
had a good clean as well. Didn't
oh
you?
Yeah, I just, I don't know where I get this song. Possibly my mother, but. If I'm ever feeling slightly stressed or want to be put into a good mood, I just clean like a madman.
He's a great housemate.
Yeah.
It's pretty good. Ideal.
Keep it in good nick.
There was a housemate of mine in Oxford who would stress bake, which was a wonderful
That's
trait.
That's pretty good. Well, I don't really bake. I like cooking kind of savoury meals, but you're a good baker.
I love to bake. I never really have the time.
I'd put you as so high, you're almost kind of like a master, a master bake. Thank you, everyone. You can use that one if you like. That's completely fine.
Thank you. For a second then, I thought you were being serious.
No, it's me.
Yeah, this is true.
I'm never serious.
Our friendship is based on various expletives directed towards each other. We were trying to work out how we could end the show, and we were like, what do we say to each other that, you know, that's uniquely us? And then it was just a bunch of words that we can't repeat
for our listeners' delicate ears.
I mean, we never said this wasn't going to be... a family show, I suppose, but we want to keep this.
We're listed as on iTunes as clean. I say
that is wrong on all kinds of levels.
I listed that. I mean, I didn't want to put us down as explicit. I don't think we're, you know, that bad.
If you meet us, you'll see why this is completely wrong.
Yeah, this is probably true.
So game. This is interesting, actually. Whilst we've been talking, I've been doing some stealthy Wikipedia-ing.
Mm-hmm.
Opera was by Carl Nielsen.
It was.
Because Wikipedia is Wikipedia, there is an article about the music of Denmark. Because name me another Danish composer off the top of your head.
Am I missing out a really obvious one?
I don't think so.
The point is there aren't many of them.
I think it'd be fair to say there aren't many. And the Wikipedia article has a subsection called the Carl Nielsen era.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he was a big influence. Him and Thomas Laub. We've gone into Germanic languages, moving away from Dan Moore tries to speak French, which is definitely a good thing. What's interesting about the article is that it says that his music became popular. Hmm. It was a form of nationalism because Denmark was having problems at the time everything was being composed with Germany. And in a way, it was art kind of reflecting societal problems at the time, which is a really interesting... sort of topic, I think. I mean, one thing that we do these concerts every week where we talk about, we sing the same music and we hear the same bits of history, so we've got this stuff ingrained into our brains. And two of the composers that we perform every week are Byrd and Tallis.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about Byrd and Tallis is that they were Catholic composers performing for the newly formed Church of England.
Yeah, so just after the Reformation, wasn't it? Well, during and obviously after the Reformation.
And I always think there's a really interesting link between... It's like music holds up a mirror to society and, you know, reflects what society is feeling at the time. And that carries right the way through to the modern day. The fact that in the 80s, there was a lot of punk, a lot of really short, sharp, to the point, brutal kind of music.
Yeah.
Which you could interpret as being like a reaction to the politics at the time. People were feeling disaffected and angry. Mm. What's interesting at the moment, though, is that as choral scholars, we certainly noticed, would it be fair to say there's kind of a golden age of choral music, like composition at the moment?
I'd say that when you've been singing for a while, you identify with music that you prefer more than others. So each person has their own golden age. So, for instance, if you were to look at the middle of, you know, 1850... to during the 1900s, you've got some pretty cool homophonic music being written. You're going away from polyphony, which Tallis and Byrd, who we were talking about, are associated with. For me, I really, really like polyphony. So I've learned that, you know, if I see a composer from slightly earlier, and how's this for a segue?
Oh, here we go. It's a Dan Moore segment. Get ready, everyone.
Have you ever heard of William Billings?
Oh, here it is.
Here it is.
It was only a matter of time.
It's come full circle.
Dan found this guy on Wikipedia and has been just a wee bit obsessed with him. Right, go on.
He's
fascinating. I'll let you say your piece.
So I believe he was born roughly around the time... He was 1745 to about 1800 was certainly his... Or the kind of the prime time where his compositions were kind of being sung. And he's considered the first American composer of choral music, which as a title is amazing. That's so cool to be considered the number one. What I find really interesting about him is that he's writing in very much a kind of an English choral style, but there is no real explanation as to why. His father died when he was about 12, and as such, that was the end of his formal education. So basically all of his music and everything that he's written is self-taught, which means that when you're looking at his music from a harmonic perspective, you can really see that it's being written to make sense for a singer, because his way of making it make sense would be the getting people together and being like, right, you sing this and you sing this, and then let's see how it sounds. And he writes in a really, really interesting style. It's you know, being that era, it sounds almost kind of like a madrigal, which is, I mean, you're far more familiar with madrigals than I am. But I just found him really, really interesting.
I mean, and this actually goes back to what I was sort of saying a minute ago, is this, I argue that choral music at the moment is in a golden age, partly because of American composers. And there are a lot of really good American composers. So he's the first in the lineage, but at the moment you've got people like Eric Whitaker, Morten Lauritsen.
Mm.
Is Joby Talbot American? Or is he British?
I think he's British.
So these are names that you might have heard of, Eric Whitaker, I suppose, but these are very niche names. Mm. But yeah, and the American style is, oh, is this, do we talk about the tragedy of Collegium Regale?
This was YouTube drama.
This
is arguably the biggest shakeup in the internet choral scene in years.
So, have we hit enough topics in this podcast yet? I don't think we've stayed on anything for more than 2 minutes.
I don't know, but this
yet.
Is important.
This needs to be said. Stay on this for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, it's choral. It's related to our original topic.
Should we do some journalism on the go, right?
I think so.
You give the intro. I'll do some research.
So, basically, there was, rest in peace, a YouTube channel called Collegium Regale, which was kind of the place to go for listening to choral music of any kind of variety. So there was a load of English stuff there, as you can guess in the title. Also a load of American things and any other non-European or European choirs that would do particularly good recordings, you'd suddenly see them cropping up. And it was a brilliant place, this massive melting pot of both kind of choral music, ancient and modern, being performed by a variety of different people. And it was just doing so much for the culture, I guess.
Yeah, and it was a great way for us to learn. Mm. It was often on in the house. But
what happened?
If you actually go to the YouTube channel now, it reads in red at the top, "This account has been terminated because we received multiple third-party claims of copyright infringement," which is completely correct.
Oh, yeah.
They were posting recordings they didn't own.
Yeah.
I'm not actually sure how many subscribers they had.
Quite a lot. From a subscriber count, I'm not sure, but you could definitely see, you know, if it was hundreds of thousands of views. Easily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a big channel.
So the interesting thing there is, surely for them to strike a copyright claim and for so many people to do so, there must have been an issue with monetization.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, what I would guess is that up until, this was a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it? Up until then, the record companies were content with taking the lion's share of the profit. Because if you were flagged, if I, for example, was to upload a video that used copyrighted music, if I used to say Ed Sheeran's music, for whatever reason, in one of my videos, it would be recognized by YouTube's algorithm that tracks through all of it and says, oh, you know, it's almost like the bad version of the Microsoft paperclip. Like, oh, it looks like you've copyrighted some music.
Can I help you?
So that then takes all the monetization, and it will give you a small fraction, but most of it will go to the people that own the copyright, which is, in my opinion, a very good way of doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that what happened with this channel was that the record companies basically saw that whoever owned the channel was probably freeloading a little bit too much, and that they were better off. Yes, the exposure was good, but they were better off just pulling all of it down and hosting it on their own services and make people buy it, which is probably true. I mean, we're probably more likely to actually buy recordings now than we were before. I mean, only very slightly more likely.
Mm.
But, you know, it's an interesting sort of part of the YouTube ecosystem, really. This is like the industry side, which we're now both getting a little bit more accustomed to.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, it was interesting that you're talking about how they kind of do it through algorithms and listening to videos, because I don't know if you know anyone that we know that might have had a copyright strike on a piece of Eric Whitaker music that wasn't actually sung by his choir. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, this happened on one of my videos. This was when we, at the end of my vlogs, if you don't know this, I have a YouTube channel where I do a vlog about being a PhD student and a choral scholar. And at the end of certain episodes, I used to put a recording of a piece of music that the choir had sung. And one week we were doing Sleep, which is a wonderful piece of music by American composer. That's almost the theme of this episode, it seems. So Sleep by Eric Whitaker. And it was just a whole piece sung by us at the end of the video. And it got copyright struck because YouTube's algorithm thought that that was the CD recording. And so I had all the monetization taken off of it, and I had to file a report and be like, I own this.
The trick would be that, obviously, this is where algorithms kind of fall short. The end of this video wasn't just the audio, it was a video of us singing the piece. So as far as the claim goes, it would have been fairly easy to...
for the lawyers to just go, oh, whoops.
Yeah, oh, hang on, we've massively
made
a mistake.
But the thing is, it did take them the full length of time that they could contest it. Like basically, there's a period of time, I think I'm right in saying, that they can contest it. And then if it gets to the end of time, of that time, and it's not resolved, then you get your copyright back. And that's what happened to me.
Right.
So it's almost like it just didn't get reviewed.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure that the way the algorithm works is it only looks at the audio. Because... certainly from a data perspective, that's much easier to do. I mean, YouTube, there's something nuts, like 100 years of footage uploaded every day to YouTube.
Yeah, I remember hearing that. The other interesting segue, if we were talking about Eric Whitaker, who anyone in the kind of choral world will absolutely kind of fangirl over. I believe, I could be wrong, but I believe either today, tomorrow, or possibly yesterday, he's doing a concert with the BBC singers in the Royal Albert Hall. To release his new, he's just done a massive new piece of writing, and it's all in one of the videos he was basically trying to describe, he wants to write like Mozart and Bach, but for a contemporary choral choir with an American edge. So this is where the new, is it?
So he's basically saying, I want to be the greatest composer ever, but with America in there.
Yeah.
You know, because... anyone who knows is, if you were to like think of classical music, you're probably thinking of Mozart or Bach. You're thinking of stuff that has very well-defined relations between it. It's very kind of crisp and clean. Is what you're, obviously there's a lot more to the works than that, but that's probably what you're thinking. Whereas Eric Whitaker is not the exact opposite. In the all the music makes sense, but it's like the chords are much denser. It sounds literally almost as far as you could be from Mozart and Bach while still writing the same kind of music.
So the way he was describing it is that he was trying to kind of explain it in the way that he was writing like he was writing for strings, but he wanted to take iconic kind of thematic American devices like the sound coming out of like Boston, or if you think about jazz in... what's that city?
New Orleans?
Yeah. Streetcar Named Desire. New Orleans. And trying to create this kind of fusion. And I think one of the pieces is called, like, Lux Americana or something like that.
Oh, you've got to be kidding me.
It's a bit cringe, but his music is a bit cringe.
Yeah,
it is. It's brilliant, but it's a little bit on the cheese factor is quite high.
It's American.
Yeah, it's American. Yeah.
Was
that you trying to think of a polite way to say it, and you came with, it's American. American. Again, just sweeping cultural generalizations.
I didn't get in trouble for this. I said this, and I did a book review recently, and I basically took issue with Michio Kaku's, he's a very respected physicist who also does a lot of popular science stuff, and I basically said he writes like an American. Presumably you get what I mean when I say that. Like, American prose is pretty identifiable. Certainly modern.
Yeah. Yeah,
but like having to explain that to be like, oh, what do I actually mean by that? I think what I mean is there's a lot of hyperbole, and it's more colloquial.
Yeah,
and I feel like that's in a way that's what American music sounds like.
Mm.
I couldn't tell you because I'm actually quite musically illiterate. I couldn't tell you exactly, you know, how that would translate.
Yeah,
but that is kind of what American music sounds like.
Yeah, you can identify with certain ways of constructing, like either harmony or writing a melody. Like, if anyone listening to the podcast is familiar with the game Civilization, the way that they wrote the theme for America.
Oh, as in Civ 5.
Yeah. Six, the most
recent one. The most recent one, yes, yeah. Six.
You hear this piece, and basically, you know, there's lots of brass and big kind of, it's very grand and majestic, and basically think about how you can almost judge a country's relationship with music specific to their country by their national anthem. Yes. If you think about, or maybe not, but iconic pieces of this country. So in England, we have a really well-known hymn set to music by Parry, Jerusalem.
Yeah. Text by Blake.
Yeah. America, if you look at the national anthem for America, you know, it's similar kind of, you know, it is, as you say, hyperbolic, a little bit kind of overly grand, but you like that. And it's, you know,
if it was a flag, it would be the Stars and Stripes, but with America huge, bold letters over the front of it.
Basically think about those really cliched film, you know, like the voiceover, coming this summer. That's basically
baloney.
That's basically America.
Yeah.
In a nutshell, both musically, like, you know, like the food, everything. That's it. Again, we're not ones for sweeping generalizations.
No, I think America in a nutshell sounds like...
Yeah. It's very clever. It's witty, too. Yeah, thank you. I really like that. Yeah, it's good.
Whittaker.
Oh, now that's even better. That's very good.
Well, now, what you also glanced over there, you just kind of like, ignore that, put that in the corner. You ignored how terrible our national anthem is. You compare the American national anthem to Jerusalem, which I kind of wish was, but also I can understand why it isn't. But God Save the Queen is awful.
It's awful, and surprisingly, or well, not surprisingly to those of these noble isles, there's been a number of times where the public have signed petitions to have it changed, and it's usually requesting, the change is usually Jerusalem.
I think the problem with Jerusalem, though, is it's the text, isn't it? It's quite warlike, if I remember correctly. I'm going to look this up.
Oh, it's not. It's not too bad.
Cheeky typing.
I think I certainly prefer the sentiment and really the kind of the musicality of Jerusalem too. God save.
Oh yeah. It's like the EastEnders theme.
Yeah. My God.
Phil Bailey does an amazing sketch about this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like it's just so plodding. Yeah, I mean, also the fact that it is literally called Jerusalem, which is a city in another country, and a very controversial one at that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fairly sure, if I remember rightly, the whole idea of using Jerusalem was, so in reference to England, is that it was trying to explain what heaven would be like.
Yeah,
so
it's the concept of Jerusalem as a city of God. And also the idea that, bring me my bow... My chariot
burning
fire.
Gold. Yeah.
My bow burning gold, that's the one. You know, it does sound quite warlike, but also it was written as a reaction by Blake to the Industrial Revolution, I think. And like kind of anti-enlightenment and stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas that's like an event which really defined the history of the UK.
And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills? Yeah, Industrial Revolution. Which, interestingly, if people can cast their minds back to London 2012.
I thought you were going to be like, the year 1760.
Yeah. Way, way back, many centuries ago. There's a whole piece in the opening show about that.
Oh, it was amazing. Movement. With Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah.
As soon as about Kingdom Brunel.
Yeah.
And it was there forging the Olympic rings. Because I remember, right, I don't know if we've ever talked about this. I remember that opening ceremony happening because I was in a tiny car driving to Snowdonia, which is this mountain range in a very desolate part of the UK called Wales. And we were listening to the commentary on the opening ceremony. And it was like, oh, and they've got these rings that are ascending into the sky.
Yeah.
We were like, oh, this is really cool. And then we talked for a bit. And then we'd listen back in the radio and be like, and there are hundreds of Mary Poppinses all descending. And there are kids in hospital beds. I'm like, what happened? Like, and I literally, we had to try streaming it on someone's 3G at the time.
Yeah.
Because we just couldn't believe it. It was such a bizarre thing. And so to only hear the audio, it was like, oh, and there's a giant Lord Voldemort. Like, no, yeah. Someone's hacked this.
This was prefaced by having Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II skydiving
with James Bond. If you haven't seen this, by the way, if by some miracle you weren't aware of the London 2012 opening ceremony, go watch a highlights reel on YouTube, because
it
was
really
nuts.
Good. Yeah, and you know, a lot of it was because the previous one was Beijing.
Yeah,
wasn't it? And that there was definitely a kind of air of, we need to try and top Beijing's opening ceremony, because they did an amazing job.
But the thing with Beijing was, let's get into the politics section of the podcast. It was all about, like, unity, right? It was thousands of people, really impressive choreography, but all doing the same thing in like, as one.
Mm.
Whereas it felt like with London, they were trying to go for the individual angle.
Yeah,
like
show emphasizing the diversity. And
emphasizing individuals like Isambard Kingdom Brunel. They had Tim Berners-Lee, mm-hmm. Inventor of the Internet, who my mum, I think, knows.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's some really obscure connection there.
Oh, wow.
And there was, I think, was it... Oh, this is where my modern music knowledge fails me. Who was it? Tiny Temper that did.
Was it Tiny Temper or Dizzy Rascal?
It was one of the two.
I don't know if you can pick up cooler music. We might know that we don't really know what we're talking about.
But again, it was the individual like being emphasised.
We obviously had Churchill's speech.
Yeah,
we will fight them on the beaches.
Also, actually, this is a Dan Moore segue. Kenneth Branagh playing. Isambard Kingdom Brunel. How much are you looking forward to the Murder on the Orient Express film?
Oh, that looks fantastic. Yeah. Where he's playing Poirot.
Yes, which is a kind of a thing to follow up by David Suchet. Have we not hit enough topics in this podcast? Yeah.
Left, right, center. Boom, 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 boom.
Because the cast is amazing.
Yeah, it does look really, really good. It looks like it's shot really well too. And interestingly, unlike other films that have been shot really, really well, it actually looks like there might be quite a decent story. I'm really sorry, Edgar Wright.
Can we get closer to the microphone?
A little bit closer.
ASMR. Hi, my name is Boxy.
Ooh, creepy.
That was a reference to the fact that we did a review of Baby Driver on our YouTube channel, Spongy and Electric.
We did.
Which it was on the very... If you wish to see how we record this, the sofa that Dan is sat on right now, poised, naked, on one side, like a chaise longue.
It's just because beforehand I did ask you to draw me like one of your French girls.
Yes, you were wearing this, only this.
Yeah.
That was the sofa that we recorded on. And can you give me a very, very, very brief summary of what you thought about Baby Driver, Dan?
Shot marvellously well, edited marvellously well. The heart of the film for me was lacking. But as I say, if you really want to get into it, and it is a good piece of...
It's a good... good piece we of definitely film. Came off as very harsh in that review.
We did, and we were harsh because we cared.
We cared. Yeah.
It was coming from a place of caring. But, you know, go and watch it and then watch our review and then
and make sure to like, comment, and subscribe.
Tell us that we're horribly cruel and just rip us to pieces, you know.
But we haven't had that yet, to be fair. People seem to be agreeing with us.
Yeah, and interestingly...
Also, one of my favourite comments of all time. I had somebody comment... I actually did a video about this recently about my weirdest comments. Somebody commented saying, you know nothing about films. So I thought, let's kill this person with kindness. Let's be nice. I was like, oh, what did you think of the film? And then he replied with, sorry, I wrote that before I watched the video. It turns out you do know lots about films.
Amazing. The finer folk of YouTube are showing themselves there.
Yep. So, Dan, what have we learned this week?
Well, we've gone from Hymnus Amoris by Carl Nielsen being his first piece of English choral writing.
I thought it was just choral writing full stop, wasn't it?
It may have just been choral writing. I'm trying to claw it back to English because we've been talking about Eric Whittaker for so much. Well,
we now can name a Danish composer.
We can, yeah. And pretty good, but apparently the critical reception...
Yeah,
we haven't
listened to it, but it was probably good.
Yeah, it was probably all right. We need to quiz your mum.
Yes,
might know it.
Because you, dear listener, have learned that I am the son of a very talented singer, it's got to be said.
Yeah. We've also discussed the film Murder on the Orient Express, which is amazing how we got there. I have absolutely no idea at all. We also, the London opening ceremony.
And a story about me being in a tiny, like, Peugeot 206 in the middle of Wales.
Oh my God. Just all here, there, and everywhere.
So that's all for this week's episode. Don't forget to subscribe to us on your podcasting service of choice. And you can like us on Facebook. And if you'd like to see our faces, you can check out our YouTube channel, Spongy and Electric.
Fan fiction, tribal offerings, and other thoughts on the show can be sent to us at spongyandelectric@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Join us again for another tumble down the wiki rabbit hole.
And we'll see you next time.